så du startade, vi startade oss själva på något sätt.
Ja, för att checka det är nog här.
Ja, ja, ja. Ja, okej. Ja, men hej hej. Men slide eller är det slide? Det kommer inte direkt ut av det, men det, ja, det kommer där. Du och du och teknologin idag kan få till.
Men vi plejer beståndig att prata om kontrast, att kontrast styr i hela livet. Så då är det grejt och det är lite sån kinomässig.
Men det var. Nej, jag blir inte med nästa vecka eller denna vecka, nu.
Nej.
Ja. För SPM i København istället för det är ett seminar där som är liksom är fortsatt liksom inte helt förnöjd. Jag har inte fått till bägge delar för att det hade varit så fint. Nu ska du dit eller?
Ja. Men så att det är kanske inte så många av de ansatte som vi var i fjol. Jag tror det är där Marius, Ali, jag, Jussi, Steven.
Okej. Okay. Ah, ja.
Där är vi i hvert fall noen.
Nej, men som han sa...
Men vi var ju många i fjol.
Ja, men Ali sa ju det. Det var bara det. Han försökte kanske inte ha råd till att invitera så många på något i fjol så hade jag på något ett eget budget på det men folk kunde ju ha dratt lite på sin egen budget också så det visste jag lite
alltså hade vi ju två år någonting var det bara en
ja yes. Nej jag räcker inte springa inte eller om jag skulle springa inte
kommer
inte
där nej
det
blir vanskeligt.
Och nu lurar jag på, men nu är jag må möjligen så dra till Gimstad och min far är då är väldigt dålig igen och så nu driver mina syskon och reser dit för och så där så
är han fortsatt hemma.
Nej, han är på som han är på omsorgsbolig typ ting där. Så han har på mode hemma sitt alltså
men alltså är fysisk att han mental är han fortsatt
nu är det liksom han har fått varit mentalt så det hela tiden men nu kommer grejer och grejer kommer han räcker inte snart han har inte fått kraft till att snacka då är det lite vanskligt
han känner
ja för en vecka sedan gjorde han det så nu är jag lite osäker på att sånt där nu så det är liksom lite så
hur gammal är han
94 eller något sånt. Så det är ju en god alla. Men jag vet liksom inte helt om jag ska dra ner dit. Några alla.
Nej, så det är
fjärde
en del av
det är det.
Dagen och livet och
ja.
Bekymringar och
ja.
Liksom livet.
Det är det. Så, men det blev inte helt nytt för. Ja.
Ja då. Så när det gäller innehållet så ni var innom
ja.
För en vecka sedan.
Ja.
Så han begynte den ene session var generellt om ja, multispektral, hyperspektral och så applikationen alltså det han driver med kultur och arv och ja, lite andra områder.
Ja.
Men det är bra att du fortäller egentligen med din infallsvinkel.
Men han har fortalt change-projekt för det på en måte. Alltså
ikke noe konkret. Han nevnte det, ja.
Men jeg får se hvordan...
ikke noe struktur og ideen og de forskjellige. forskjellige PhD-er
okay. og det. Okay. Men den idé har fått om spektral
generelt,
har du fått for ham.
Ja, ja, ja. Men det greit å gjenta det. Ja. Det har vi jo sett før. At det,
ja, ja.
Det en
god idé. Så jeg får se. Siste gang så husker jeg brukte mer tid på denne, for de hadde mye spørsmål og sånt, så ble det ikke så mye tid i prosjektet. Men da kan jeg på en måte gi dem, de kan få slidene av om de prosjektet. For det er ikke så viktig å ha detaljer i prosjektet egentlig. Så vi får se hvordan jeg brukte det de par timene som er her.
Spectral, spectral to the people. Then tomorrow we will move on to material appearance, translucency as the visual attribute. Now we talked a lot about color so far, so it's the time to spend on other visual attributes. And then tomorrow afternoon there will be also an interesting talk related to experimental setup under controlled conditions, as a viewer condition versus uncontrolled viewing conditions or setup. And then the discussion how or which data we can trust more or what is needed so that the two data sets are comparable with each other. And probably that is again something important for you guys in the cross-media collaborative production course where some of you need to set up and conduct an experiment. So then you learn more about how to set up and what kind of experiment to conduct. But now I'm happy to have Jon Yngve back in, and I mean you are probably the colleague or the professor who has started with multispectral very first back in your PhD.
Not the first to do multispectral imaging, but they have been for most. Yes, sure, sure.
And I'm very happy to have you, and we are looking forward
yeah.
to hear your story. Thanks.
Glad to be here. Yeah, glad to see you guys. You are all course students, or are there any? Oh wow. So,
yes.
No.
Yeah,
sure. It's.
I did expect also some.
Some exchange, or do you have exchange?
Yeah, Erasmus students, some PhDs started initially, so maybe they prioritize.
Yeah, sure.
Else.
So, but it's very nice to see this the cohort, to see you guys. You know, you've been around here for a while. I haven't really been able to kind of talk to you, so this is my first time to talk to you, and I hope it will not be the last. I look forward to kind of discussing with you and exchanging ideas with you also later. I'm John Hardberg. I have been here in Gjøvik since 2001, doing a lot of research and project management, supervision for PhD students, and some teaching, but mostly in a very research-close teaching like this, but also in the third semester I have an advanced color imaging course that I teach to the to you guys if you come back here next semester, and also others. Before I did my PhD in France, between the PhD and coming here, I was in the US in Seattle, working in the company there on color imaging stuff. And before that, I did my master in signal processing. So that's kind of my foundation. Good. So I will talk about multispectral imaging, not really about hyperspectral imaging. I heard you had Sony talking to you about that. So sometimes we say spectral imaging to cover the whole field. And, you know, and typically kind of, okay, what is the difference between the multi and hyperspectral imaging? You know, that can be a question that you could, you know, I don't know. If you wanted to be nasty, you can get that in the exam. But I don't think so, because it's not really, there's not really one answer to that. You might, well, of course, there's kind of the number of channels, right? Sony has been talking about hundreds of channels in the spectral space. I will be pushing that in the other direction towards three, you know. That's kind of where I'm starting with color. That's three channels, right? So I'm kind of more in the lower end here. And that doesn't mean that I'm also not doing hyperspectral. Well, here, kind of, you know, the focus is a little bit to push it down, to make it maybe fast and easy, and, you know. And you know, what do you need? Well, you know, that depends on your application, right? In some cases, you would need the high-end things that we have locked down in the room in the cellar, you know, really the high-end hyperspectral equipment. In some cases, you would like to have it, I don't know, who knows, on the mobile phone or something like that, maybe. So so that's kind of where we will go today. The introduction to the concept, what we can call multispectral imaging, some applications, some examples, and then focus a little bit on where I see the challenges are in terms of why, you know, adoption, you know, why is it not used even more? You know, what can be the things to do to make it more usable? I will go a little bit into some approaches, some research kind of that goes in that direction before concluding. So, this is color imaging, right? I mean, you have probably seen some variants of this diagram here before, where there is kind of the core components of a color imaging or vision system. If you just exchange a camera with, you know, with an eye, you know, it would be almost the same. You have a spectral power distribution of the light, different wavelengths, and the different wavelengths get reflected differently from the surfaces, the spectral reflectance, right? That's a kind of key concept here. And then you have the spectral sensitivity of the sensor. And all of that fits nicely together in an equation. You know, I don't know how many of you like that. You know, some of us kind of like, well, that's nice. We can put up a nice linear equation to describe it, and that's kind of comfortable and good to know. Of course, if we were talking about color, we would talk about how when this fails, you know, when this is kind of the basics of it, and then everything happens afterwards in the brain, messing things up. But this is still, a foundation, and this is really what kind of is happening in the eye, and that's what's happening at the sensor level of a color imaging system. And fundamentally, this kind of mathematically kind of describes the concept of metamerism. You have heard about metamerism before. Good, yes, okay, that's good. So different spectra have the same color, you know, and that is not, it's not crazy or weird. It's, you know, it's very mathematically, you can look at this equation, there's many spectral shapes that would integrate to the same three values, you know. So there's nothing really strange in that, but, you know, most people don't know about that. You know, most people have some idea what color is, but they don't really realize this kind of mapping from the spectral space to color. So that's good to know. It can give surprises like this. Of course, it's also a good thing that allows us to show natural colors on different devices, even if the spectra are not the same. So it's really useful. Now, I will here kind of focus on that as a limitation of color imaging, right? Because, you know, we are going from the full spectral space into a very reduced three-dimensional space. And usually with color imaging, we are only considering the visible part of the spectrum, and we kind of get only this kind of three numbers of color information. And there's a lot of dependency on the illuminant here, because the spectrum that the color camera is seeing, you know, is a mixture, you know, of the light and the object, right? And kind of trying to separate those is a very hard problem, because you're kind of in this three-dimensional space. I don't know, somebody should surely talk to you about color constancy, color, you know, white balancing of cameras, you know, all kind of things in color imaging that kind of tries to deal with this. So here now I'm kind of saying, well, let's consider that we, you know, we don't reduce to three channels, we go beyond that, like we have more than three channels. And with that, we can set up a similar model, you know, to understand kind of how that system is working, just with more than three channels in the system. And basically, also one way of seeing it is that we have, you know, we have a scene that we're looking at. You know, the camera is looking at some kind of scene. Every point of that, every object, every surface point of that scene has a certain spectral reflectance. And what we're trying to do, you know, what we will be trying to do is to kind of, from the multispectral image, is to try to recover that spectral reflectance. It doesn't necessarily come directly, right? You have to do some tricks to do that. Don't hesitate to interrupt me, raise your hand, stop me along the way. You know, I don't have a, I mean, we have until 1 o'clock, so we can use that in any way we want. So. I will show you some examples of how we do multispectral imaging, but here's kind of the basic, I would say, the fundamental principle here, where you have a, you don't see my pointer, if I, yeah. You have a monochrome sensor in the camera. It's a more panchromatic, or, you know, it's just one channel. But then you have a set of optical filters, and you have to take several images, several shots of the same scene through these different filters. So then, you know, doing that sequentially, you're getting a multispectral image. You're getting a multi-channel image that we can call a multispectral image. And it's a very basic principle. And actually, you can say that this dates actually back to even before the multispectral, but really to one of the very early color image reproduction ideas that this famous Maxwell guy came up with, because he, in order to make, well, he had a black and white cameras of the time, and then took three shots through three different optical filters. Okay, so if it took three different images, you know, like RGB images actually, but, you know, on analog film. And then how to reproduce that was the problem, because you didn't have the chemistry to make a color print. Now then he actually took slide projectors. I don't know. We still have some of these old slide projectors in the lab where you can put a kind of a 35mm slide. But you took three of them, you know, and added the same filter, the same three filters to the three of them, and put the three images, three photos that they had developed in black and white in the three of them, and aligned them together, and magically a color image appeared on the screen. So it's a very basic principle. You just kind of, you know, and this is, you know, I think it's just fun to see how this kind of
links. Yes. We do have in the lab, and we can reproduce that not with a slide projector, but with an overhead. I tried.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, you have to. Yes.
Principle.
Yes.
But then, in addition to that, what is interesting, then replacing one of the filters.
Yeah.
Appearance.
Yes. Okay.
That is
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
land did basically.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how we kind of are able to adapt to these kind of limited situations. Yes.
So that we permits, and you're interested, then I'm happy to do the analog setup.
You know, and how many projectors do you have? Because if you have more than three, we could actually make a spectral reproduction. You know. And we could actually make, you know, reproduce the spectrum this way. That would be fun. We need to get out on the market and buy some of these old overhead projectors. Good, you know, and but with this principle, I mean, we have multispectral cameras in the lab that use this principle. It's very kind of straightforward and easy to make. There can be some variants. This filter here, you could choose to put it in the light path instead. You know, like put it in front of the light source. And, you know, if you go to the equation, you know, the math of it then becomes exactly the same. Because, like, you know, it's all a linear system. In practice, it's not exactly the same because things happen. The lighting is not, or, you know, the filters are not perfect. There are some aberrations, optical aberrations happening and stuff like that. So in some cases, that can be a good idea to do it that way, because then you have less in the way of the perfect image here. But then again, if you don't control the light source, because there could be other, you know, this is also something we can come back to. You know, in the lab, we could kind of turn off all the other light and control the light completely. In a other situation, or outside or whatever, we don't control the light, so then how would we do it? Anyway, that's kind of just one of the main principles, and now I will, you know, reproduce some of the kind of arguments why, you know, multispectral imaging might be good. This metamerism, you're not going to the reduced color space, you're going to a higher dimensional subspace, and then you have less metamerism problem. You can use it to really make accurate color. You know, if in the end what you want is color, then going through a multispectral image as one face can be a good starting point for that. Sometimes I call this whole concept, I call it for multispectral color imaging, which is maybe a little bit strange as a concept, but somehow it emphasizes that very often, for very many applications that we care about, we would like to have a visual color image that is as good as possible. We want more than that behind the scene, but the color image is what we very often want to look at. So this kind of link between the spectrum and the physical, the spectral, and also the perceptual is still there. We can also extend it beyond the visible spectrum, and the key message here is that we want to capture the spectral reflectance of the theme. That is kind of when I kind of talk about multispectral imaging, that's kind of the target. How do we measure the spectral reflectance of the scene? It's not necessarily always the case. I mean, there are many cases where you can just take a multispectral, multi-channel camera, use it. You can train it for some kind of classification, or, you know, use it for some kind of diagnosis without trying to recover the spectral reflectance. So I'm not saying that is the only kind of reason to do it, but in my kind of very often, I mean, it's a little bit like with color cameras. I mean, you can take color cameras and you can enhance the images, so you can get some really nice photographs out of it, but it's, I would argue that it's a good idea to have it colorimetrically characterized so you know what it's doing. And then you can always kind of build an application on top of that that kind of goes away from this kind of fundamental calibrated thing. So the color camera, that will be the calibration to a standard color space that Phil will talk more about it in cross-media color production, kind of those principles. Now here I would say the fundamental, you know, data that you would like to have is the spectral reflectance of the scene. So that, you know, you want to remove the light. Spectral reflectance is property of the object, right? That's kind of, but as I said, you know, you can't skip that. Depending on application, you can do whatever you like. Imaging spectral, well, it's just saying that there are some, it can be one way of looking at it. If people that are used to measuring the spectral effectiveness with a spectral photometer, you can say that, well, what we're trying to do here is a spectral photometer that measures a whole surface, you know, a whole image, a whole field. So imaging spectroscopy is another word. So quickly, I'll just kind of run through some examples, giving you, well, just some visuals of things that exist. Also, you can see some mentioning some institutions or some places where, you know, some of the early and core research has been done for this. RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology, for instance, the Mount Sol Color Science Lab there, they have developed a lot of multispectral imaging. Here you can kind of see this system here. You have, this is the camera back here, and then you have the filter wheel in the box. Okay, now it disappeared here, you know, like this, and it's motorized, so it can turn. You can also do it manually, you know, and you can buy cameras and buy a few filters and kind of manually take them on and off and take, you know, one shot for each. It's a way to do it, but it's nice. The easier you can make, well, that's easier to build, you know, because we have tried to do that. We have built a camera like this with the motor, you know, with filter, you know, running. It's always, at least for those of us who are not so good with developing hardware, you know, it's a challenge to make this work well, you know, but it's possible.
Are these typical narrow band filters or broad band or mixed?
Yeah, that is typically one of, you know, the challenges. Maybe I come back to that, you know, but kind of designing what is the optimal filters here is a question that, you know, we have researched throughout time, and also how many channels do you need? 2, 4, 6. Okay, you know, do you need more or less? Well, and the answer to this question is always, it depends on. Now, for the specific narrow band versus wide band, I can also give you papers that kind of look specifically into that. There are pros and cons of both. Ideally, you could imagine that you want narrow band because you want to precisely sample the spectrum, right, at the different wavelengths. But then in the end, if they are too narrow, then, well, you know, it's all black. There's almost no light going through. And then in order to get a good image of that, you really need a long exposure time. And then you can also have, even, I don't know, some of you, if you have some signal processing kind of background, you can think of this as sampling, right? And there can be problems with spectral aliasing or whatever, you know. I am often a guy for compromises, seeing that, well, you know, we can maybe find some, you know, so relatively narrow band, but not super narrow band, with some overlap. The thing is, when you have overlap, the more overlap you have to do the processing afterwards. You kind of have to unmix the challenge, the channels somehow in the next step. And that is kind of this. I can talk more about that later. Kind of spectral reconstruction. You need to kind of characterize your system to be able to go from the direct images that the camera is giving you to a representation of the spectral reflectance. If you have broadband filters, then you're not getting that directly. Some other systems here from Japan, Chiba University is also one of those places where there's been a lot of development done here, and also you see Mitsubishi, a company, has been involved. So there's more and more companies also involved here. Here's was one classical system from Aachen in Germany. You can see the same camera as we saw on top here. And now it's everything is built in a box to control the light. And then you can put the sample on this here and put it in like this. Here's a more kind of homemade device that was done in Burgundy, in Dijon. Also one of our partners that we have collaborated a lot also on research in this area. This camera we have in the lab, this is a commercially available camera. So you can see the filter wheel. What this is showing, the nice thing is that we can actually, I mean, even a relatively advanced user, but kind of a user like us, would be able to open this up and remove the filter and put in another filter. So we don't have to send it back to the manufacturer. We can kind of play with which filters to use ourselves. Now, of course, that's not. I'm going to talk more about the user here. You know, who's the users of this system, and not all users would be comfortable in doing that. So there are many different levels of users for a system like this. But it's a nice system. Another approach here that I worked with during my PhD back in Paris. You don't see that all that well, but here is actually what we could call a liquid crystal tunable filter. So it's a kind of electronically tunable filter. So by you can change the sensitivity. You can electronically. So then you don't have to have several filters on a wheel. You can kind of just control that device to let through different parts of the spectrum and take several pictures through that. There are others also have been using that. Here you can see that they put the filter between the camera here and then the filter and then the lens. And it's challenging because, I mean, I don't know, any of you have how much optics you have studied? I'm not so good with the kind of geometrical optics and stuff like that, but I know that when you start doing this, you mess with everything, right? Because a camera and its lens is very nicely tuned to be able to get the focused image on the sensor, right? That's not so easy. And then if I move this out like this and put something in between, you lose the image completely. So of course, then you can choose another lens. Optically, theoretically, it's not all that difficult. You know, this is all well described. But in practice, sometimes it's easier. I think I have an image of, in this one. So we did it the simpler way to put the filter in front of the lens, right? So you can see the camera here, optics, and then the tunable filter is here. I think I have a close-up here also. So that then we don't mess with that basic optics. But of course we do limit the field of view of this, because usually a camera like this would see a bit broader field of view, and now we're kind of limiting that. So it's all comes with its different kind of trade-offs. But it's the kind of thing that you can play around with, experiment with, manipulate, existing or things you can buy off the shelf and put it together, and you can make your own multispectral camera. A completely different approach to multispectral imaging is to use the LEDs, light emitting diodes, as active illumination. That means, or you can say spectral illumination, because the LEDs, you can get them actually in many different wavelengths. You can buy LEDs that has a certain spectral power distribution that covers, that hits different kind of wavelengths, and then putting together a system with all of those, you can take sequential images with the different lights going through the spectrum. So then you can actually make a spectral imaging device without the filters, but using the LEDs instead. And this has some really nice advantages, actually, in terms of energy, for instance, and heating and all of that. Because usually, if you remember, even before I said you could have a light source and then you could have a filter wheel in front of it. Now, if you want to have a lot of light, you will notice that filter gets really hot. Because if you put that close to the light, it is a problem. And also, all of that heat is energy thrown away. Now here with the LED, it's just emitting light at the wavelength it does. That's its native wavelength, and it's not throwing away any energy. So, and that also, not only for the filter, but actually for the object. This is something we have to, whether we do multispectral or hyperspectral imaging, or color imaging for that sake, we have to kind of think about, do we expose too much light to the object? Does that damage it in some way? Sony talked about the cultural heritage as an application, right? We don't want to damage those old, paintings or whatever it is that we're working with. Or it could be skin. We don't want to expose the skin to too much radiation either. That's not good, right? So this can be an approach where that helps that. There are some...
There are LEDs available also up to 2,500 nanometers. Also in the infrared region, or is that again a limitation?
There are limitations. I cannot answer that for how far it goes up in infrared, because in the systems we have made for this ourselves. We have been focusing on the visible range and maybe a little bit up towards 900, 800. There are LEDs. Whether we can get them further off, I don't know. It's also a problem that there is, like, if you look in the middle of the range, there is a kind of a gap where, because, I don't know how to make these LEDs, but it's very, physical how they generate their light, right? It depends on the atoms and how the, electrons jump between different energy levels and stuff like that. So you cannot just tune them to generate any wavelength you want. You need to kind of find the right materials and things like that to do it. So
otherwise, in the previous systems, is it mainly halogen illuminate?
Yeah, halogen is quite popular because typically for spectral imaging, we want to start with a relatively continuous spectrum. So that so halogen, so a tungsten, in general, but the halogen version, sure, that works well, If we start with fluorescent light and stuff like that, you will look at the spectral distributions are really spiky like this, and it's not impossible, but it kind of makes the working with it a bit harder. Now, the problem with halogen light is that, I don't know if you can visualize the spectrum. I will draw like this, because it has very little energy in the blue end of the spectrum, and then has more and more up in the red end, and more in the infrared. In thermal range, it has also a lot. That's why heating. But actually, the problem that it has little in the blue end is problematic, because we would like to have a good measurement of the spectrum also in the blue region. So that's a challenge that's been around for a long time with those. So now with LEDs, you can play with that, and you can. But then again, I said we wanted smooth spectra. While the LEDs are not smooth at all; they are very spiky. So you have to kind of deal with that. So, but it's interesting. We have made some systems in the lab with this. I mean, you can buy. This is kind of made for cultural heritage, for books and other things like that. So you can get them on the market. But we have also done some things in the lab where we have made systems with LEDs we can control, stuff like that. And there is. I don't know if I is Giorgio talking?
Yeah.
So he will probably mention, maybe, I don't know if it's, well, you can ask him about it, because together with Giorgio, we made a system with LED lighting aimed at scanning film, so transparent film objects. So then we kind of have built up with the LEDs and kind of mixing the light and making the optics and sending the light through the film up to the monochrome camera. So it's the same principle that this monochrome camera, spectral light that you contribute, that you control, except that you have to look at the geometry. It's different for a transparent film.
We will introduce this device.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Just continuing through the kind of different examples. This is also a nice device. I actually saw it several years ago, and it was a kind of small company, Spectral Masters, who kind of made this. And it's really taking the concept of saying, well, we know a spectrophotometer, right? I mean, if you haven't seen it in the lab, okay, let's just build a device that kind of scans that over the surface very precisely. So you can put in a document here, a flat object, and this will kind of very slowly scan in both directions, kind of over there, and that makes a spectral imaging at the end. So we could go further, because I don't know if Sony talked about the spectral cube somehow. You have the hyperspectral image, so it has the two dimensions of the spatial dimension, and then you have the dimension spectral dimension. So it's going to come as a data cube, and somehow if you wanted to discuss all of these different ways to capture spectral images, you can look at how they are kind of trying to subsample this cube. We have an illustration of this. If this is spatial dimension, right? The basic multispectral imaging is taking one slice here, one slice here, one slice, like this. The hyperspectral scanner, it's taking a slice like this and scanning through, like this. And then there are other approaches, you know, and this would kind of take one voxel at a time, you know, go through the whole kind of thing. Or no. It will take a column here at a time, the full spectrum, you know, at point by point by point going through. And then there are other approaches that they will get to that actually would you know, sample, you know, subsample in both directions at the same time. Right.
How to obtain the pixel value. So if you go back to his lecture notes, then there are perhaps three or four kind of three different main methods.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So I think all of these you can kind of these examples you can kind of put them in that system. So. And very often there will be the case that you actually capture not the whole cube, and you have to do something to get the full cube. You know, if let's say if you did the sampling of the slices like this, you would try to interpolate to get the in between, or maybe if you want to really be precise, you're not necessarily sampling. But that would be if you're sampling a really precise wavelength, right? If you're broadband sampling, there would be a kind of mixture of all this. So it's not always that simple. But I think it works as a concept. Application areas. Well, there are many where this has been used and is still used, and in some cases it's been, you know, really well deployed and has been around for a long time in application areas. In others, it's more new. I mean, cultural heritage. Sony talked about it. I mean, I will mention the change project afterwards. That this is an area where we use a lot of spectral, I mean, multispectral, hyperspectral. For different cultural heritage applications. Remote sensing is also, you know, you have satellites with spectral imagers on them that has been there for a long time. Interesting to mention, I don't know if anyone is going to talk about that, but NTNU has, for the first time, they have their own satellite with an own-built hyperspectral imaging system on it that's, you know, orbiting the Earth as we speak. That's very cool. You know, we're not taking any credit for it from here because it's people in Trondheim who have done it. But we are actually working with them now, and we have over the summer. I don't know, Stephen has been working with some students who capture, because it was passing a lot over the lake Mjøsa here, and we were kind of looking at data from there too. So that's nice. So that's kind of a remote sensing, medical imaging. It can be many different areas of medical imaging where multispectral has been used. For skin is kind of one, you know, dermatology, you know, looking at trying to detect or diagnose skin cancers. That's kind of a big topic where multispectral has been and is used, but also for more intra or more in operations, stuff like looking at the brain during surgery to kind of monitor the different kind of tissues. Typically, you want to distinguish between the nasty tissues that you want to cut out and the good thing that you want to leave. You know, that's very crucial, especially in the brain. And spectral imaging can help make that the distinction, right? Yes, biometrics, surveillance applications, military applications, they are also there. More kind of quality control situation where, you know, in the production line can we inspect a different kind of product to check whether they have the right quality or to sort them or whatever. It's a big area. Computer graphics, well, that's something that's not in the image capture directly. It's more like in the spectral modeling of scenes, of objects, spectral rendering. But also that links to spectral image capture because you typically want to mix real world data with synthesized data, and doing that spectrally is a hot topic. It's been around as a concept for a very long time, but it's very, I mean, graphics are already limited by the computational power. You know, you really want to kind of get the most out of the computational power you have available, and doing everything spectrally, it just kind of, well, it's just linearly goes up, you know, typically. You have three channels. If you want to do all the processing in, you know, 10 spectral channels, well, you spend more time. But it's not necessarily, it's not exponentially changing, but still, that has been one of the limiting factors. But it's actually happening quite a lot in the computer graphics these days, so that could be worth pursuing. Printing, you know, is also another field where actually having a spectral image, can we reproduce it? Well, we have done research on that, you know, in using printers where we can mix many different channels, many different inks that, you know, and if we model them, if we do that spectrally, we can actually try to reproduce the spectral reflectance of an original. So that for some applications, that is actually useful. And then, you know, computer vision, there's you know, many examples of, let's say, spectral imaging, spectral, you know, calculations and modeling used for different kind of classifications and stuff like that. And, well, then the question to consumer imaging, I mentioned my mobile phone here. I don't know, you know, should we, is there reasons to do spectral imaging on that? That's the question for you guys. Anyway.
I just have something to add onto the document forensics. So yesterday we had a customer coming with a letter or an envelope from 1870 with three stamps on it. And then the question was whether the middle stamp was a kind of fake. And he said that so this letter with these original stamps, it's worth about $500,000. So, but he was suspicious because the stamp in the middle on the physical stamp with black ink on the stamp.
Yes.
That he was suspicious whether that has been placed there afterwards, and visually it was not possible to see a difference. So then we took an image with the spectral or hyperspectral camera, and then we were able to see a kind of significant or not significant, but it was a difference between the ink color from the other two stamps versus the one in the middle. So he will use that as a kind of a further documentation to use that to argue that probably this might be fake. Very interesting.
I wish I'd seen that yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, I should have been there. That's so cool. But it's also difficult.
It's very difficult.
Because you might see a difference, and what is the reason for that difference? Is it because the ink is different?
Exactly.
Is it because the stamp is different? Is it because something happened to it, it kind of got washed out or faded in a different way, and that's making the difference?
Exactly.
So
our talk was not to be able to say this is fake or it's real. So we just we contribute with some data, and then it's up to the expert actually
decision.
In addition with some other proofs or evidences with microscopy visually, you know, 70 times enlargements and, you know. But
we have been approached also, you know, I mean there are a lot of questions like this, you know, is who painted this painting or you know, and sure, we can scan it hyperspectrally, we can say something about, we can find out something about what pigments have been done, we can, you know, blow it up and look very closely, you know, with the images and visualize things better, stuff like that. But making conclusions on it, that's hard, you know. Especially, as you say, valuable, so that, you know, whether it's fake or not will affect its value, and it's research-wise, you know, and even research ethics-wise, it's kind of a difficult thing. But then again, we should use the technology available for these kind of things. It's
it's also hard. We saw, you know, so if you zoom in or you do the analysis just pixel by pixel, or you choose one pixel at this area, and then you choose a pixel, you know, which is kind of just a few pixel away from the first one, then you have already some differences. So then the question is, you know, certain area and then you compare that to the suspicious area, but still you have some noise there. So it is not very clear. So it is a little bit fuzzy.
And
but then at the end, getting this average and average share, you can
and it's it's so easy also to jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
Because anyway, we want to be researchers and we want, you know, we have really good data.
Exactly.
But then, you know, wouldn't it be nice to discover, to be able to see, yeah, I think this is it. I don't know what you would like to see. That is fake or it's, you know, it's some. I know myself, I have been asked to be kind of expert to look at some data in some court kind of cases and stuff like that, looking at some documents. And it's so easy to overlook something and then kind of just jump to conclusions. So I think, you know, being careful with your conclusions is. But there's a very interesting case of this with forgeries and stuff like that. I would like to mention.
So, what is your opinion? In addition to use spectral approach, also with BRDF. So now, I mean, the setup. 45 illumination,
yeah.
And zero is the measurement. So then, what about if you change also the viewing angle or the illumination angle and you capture again spectral?
Yes.
So then you would gather even more information at different angles, and then you could perhaps even get a better.
Yes.
As you say, you know, between different inks. Because the
yes,
one ink gives a different response with a different viewing angle or capturing angle.
Yes, and you could
would
be able to
be kind of.
I mean, because you don't only want to study the ink properties itself. You want to kind of understand how it was applied.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think and that, you know, if that was two different stamps. So if it was one stamp and one carefully trying to mimic a stamp with a pen or stuff like that. But it looks really good. But if you look closer to it, and including with this kind of different angles,
yeah,
that actually gives information about the shape of it, can be a way to understand that. And I think also we I'm not really a computer scientist, but sometimes we kind of computer scientists, we would like to come up with an algorithm that can classify that, this is fake or real, you know, it's a simple classification, it's yes or no. So if we get enough data and we train it, then we can do the classification, right? But that, first of all, we don't necessarily get all the data. And also, it's not always you want the computer to make that classification. You want the computer to help the expert understand what has happened, what is this, you know, what material is it, how was it made, so, you know, and understand that. And then the whole visualization part comes in. Because, you know, maybe we can capture all of this data and then we can visualize it in a really good way that can help understand this. One example I want to mention before I go on or before we take a small break is about these really, really old manuscripts called the Dead Sea Scrolls. I don't know if you heard about it. We are in a project that we're working on them. This was... And actually, there's a lot of problem with forgeries there because they are so valuable. They are so kind of iconic. These manuscripts that people pay a lot of money to have because it's like the oldest piece of the Bible you can find, right? That's very kind of wow. I want to have that. So there's a lot of forgeries. And one example of that is really looking very closely at the images, not even spectrally, but then seeing that actually. The ink, you know, how was the ink put on top of this material? And they were able to kind of visualize and show very clearly that, you know, it's not paper, you know, it's a... I forget what it's in English. It's a, you know, it's made from skin. It's kind of produced... forget about it. Anyway, it's a kind of a natural kind of, and you could see that the ink was kind of following, the ink was kind of clearly on top of an old material. If this has been an old material with ink, and then it has been stored for 1,000 years, you would have seen that it had worn differently. You would see that the tops of it would have been worn off. There would have been more ink down in the bottoms and stuff like that. But now the ink is nicely on top of the old material, and that kind of shows that this, you know, this cannot be, you know, old ink or old material. So I kind of like that, because and you can see the images of it. You know, we can light that, and you could show this, and you can, well, so this kind of becomes an evidence that's so clear that eventually the world accepted that explanation, and it changed a lot in the whole domain, because a lot of these forgeries were now in museums all over the world. They thought they were real. So,
just
an example.
Yeah, just it came to my mind, coming back to this stamp. So now we used, obviously, reflective light, considering that the material or the letter is opaque. But we could also try,
yeah,
you know, with
backlight. Yeah. Yes.
And then check the
you have to get it back, you know, because we have the hyperspectral with the light from the bottom also.
Okay,
so
we could have tried as well. Okay. I need to get back this.
Good. Should we, you know, take 10 minutes break?
Okay.
Is that okay?
12:15.
This is the chapter. I'm going to add it. make this version.
Yes, oh,
okay. So does that, I know that.
Want to
used to write comprehensive scientific literature review, so please use a spreadsheet and kind of a working title and potential expert, so that we have some progress. So I'm aware of that you need some time to get some input from different topics. So that is a kind of one of the timeline, but then we also have, in addition to the timeline, we have a deadline to take care of. So those who are not sure about what to explore, there will be also some time on Thursday and Friday on the, what is it called, camp, cozy camp?
C4.
Okay.
Yes.
So then there will be also time to discuss and to reflect, so that you very soon know what to dig into. Okay? Thanks.
Yeah.
And multispectral, obviously there is
yes,
still
there's
room.
Plenty of things to dig into.
Yeah.
I would be happy if some of you would do that. That would be nice. So, continuing a bit into here. So, I don't know. Have you seen this before? The technology hype cycle. It's been used by like technology analysts who kind of looking at different technology in society, you know, and development of new technology and stuff like that. And this typically kind of goes through, you know, new technology comes in, and then, you know, it's a lot of hype. Everyone is super happy and all, you know, the research and, you know, everything is going on. And then it shows up that it's not as easy as we thought, you know, and maybe it doesn't, okay, this was more difficult than we thought, so, you know, take some time going up here, and then hopefully, you know, slowly we're getting up to, you know, productivity, you know, where this is actually useful and it goes into the market and everything. So I discovered this kind of first time from a colleague called Raja Bala. He from the US. He presented you know, the different kind of color imaging technologies back in the number here, 2005, so it's a while ago. But, you know, it's interesting. You see some of the topics here. You know, I'm going to talk about spectral here. Spatial, well, that means the kind of the not just, well, you know, the spatial domain, image processing, kind of looking at how colors relate to each other. Goniometric, well, we'll talk about multiple angles and stuff like that, you know, very early there. And then, let's say, this is kind of the color management. sRGB is a standard color space, ICC color management, you know, close to getting to somewhere where it's really useful. And of course, we hope that something has changed since 2005. I don't have a new graph how these things are now, and maybe more importantly, okay, what are the new things coming up here that we should be aware of? But I've been kind of thinking maybe with spectral imaging, maybe we are here. It's, of course, that's kind of approximate. Depends on a lot of things, you know, because in some cases spectral imaging has been useful for a long time. It's another, you know, for other application areas. In other, you know, cases, it's maybe further away. But maybe, you know, I would say maybe we're here now. You know, we're no longer, you know, here, but we're here. So what are the challenges today? I think cost is still a challenge. I mean, there's a whole range of costs depending on the solution you make, but and depending on your needs, it might fit well, but it might still be a challenge. And I think still, I mean, I've been talking about this for several years, and things are happening, but there's still work to do on the you know, user friendliness as a, you know, a general world here, because it's sometimes it's too complicated. You know, I mean, you guys, sure. You can choose a project on multispectral imaging, and you will be able to do that just fine. Scientifically, you know, you can calibrate, you can do things the way you can, and that's nice. But what about those who are studying, or the one who are, you know, other fields, not imaging, but they are in the application field, or practitioners who have been working in, you know, in agriculture or in medicine or in, you know, conservators working in cultural heritage, who do not really have the technical background that you guys have. How user-friendly is it for them? And that goes for setting up the system, kind of, you know, calibration. How do you set it up properly? But also how do you use the data? How do you analyze it? How do you visualize it? And how do you even storage and stuff like that? You know, metadata. There's so many things to think about that are not necessarily fully developed so that end users, you know, it's ready to be used. Well, I'm not saying that this doesn't exist. I mean, things are happening. There are better and better software out there, and you can products that come with software that are better and better, but there's still work to be done there. One thing I will be focusing a little bit on here is the kind of the speed of it. You know, we would like to have one shot, point and shoot. In many applications, that would be good. Especially if you are working with moving scenes, like, you know, things that are not kind of stationary in the lab. Another topic that I kind of put up here is the one of image quality. I think surely you will have others talking about image quality as a research topic, because that's something we have done a lot in the Color Lab. Now here, you know, how to quantify the quality of spectral images. They are, in addition to let's say what counts for color images, there are more aspects, more dimensions, more kind of things that matter, and it becomes important to kind of be able to measure that and quantify the quality of one thing is that very often there are trade-offs, right? We might have, okay, we have very good color image quality, we would like to add more spectral channels. That comes at a cost. So if we say, well, we want to add more spectral channels without losing the color quality or without it taking more time, without it being more costly, well, then there are all these kind of trade-offs. So how can we balance the different things up against each other? Good. So now I will go through some concepts that are more or less on the research domain, things that can be done towards kind of this fast and easy. So. One, you know, multi-camera, using several cameras, filter arrays, not filter wheels, but filter arrays, I will explain that, using LED illumination, already mentioned briefly, and then in the wild, well, that is kind of some thinking about how can we do, if we take the multispectral system out of the lab into nature or, you know, in a place where it's not controlled, what are the challenges and possible solutions there. So the first multi-camera is a quite simple concept, really. It is, and you can use existing technology for stereo images, right? There are good reasons to put several cameras in a device. Some mobile phones have it. You can buy this Fujifilm camera here. You can actually buy, or I don't know if it's still on the market, but it used to be on the market at least. Or you can, you know, make one yourself, putting different cameras together. And why you would do that is to generate stereo images, depth perception, right? Now we can say, well, we can use this for something else. We can modify these two cameras optically so that they capture two different images spectrally, and, you know, by that making a six-channel spectral imaging device. Or we could even go further and do more. So let's now kind of just go through the process or an example project where we did just that. So we were working with this Fujifilm consumer camera here, and the goal is to kind of to modify the two cameras and make it multispectral. So then comes all the questions. How do you choose, you know, how do you actually do this in practice? I mean, conceptually, I don't know, maybe I went too fast, but to me, conceptually, it's relatively simple. But how, you know, how does it work? How well does it work? How to choose the filters in particular? So I will not go through in the details of this kind of just quickly and forget how, you know. Well, so what we did, for instance, is that we had to measure the camera. You know, what, you know, to start with, how does our camera work, right? Then we need to measure these sensitivity functions here of the camera. So these are the two for the two cameras. This we can do with the monochromator system in the lab. You know, we it takes some time, and it's kind of a laborious process, but it kind of can, we can measure the sensitivity of these cameras. And then we had a set of filters, and by simulating the system, we can optimize it. So we can have a full model of this system with these sensors, different filters, and then with some kind of goal of, you know, how do we, what do we want to optimize? Then we can, you know, choose the best filters for it. So this is kind of the typical model you've seen before, you know, and then, well, I'm not going further. I could do that another time if you like, but you know, so you have. You have to choose some patches, you know, some colors for training the system, and then you test the system, and then you evaluate. Here you can see we evaluate the root mean square spectral error. We can also evaluate the delta E color error if we want this to kind of give good color. And then we can look at different spectral estimation methods because, you know, when you capture through, you know, these kind of sensitivities here, you know, you have to do something to try to get to the best possible spectral reflectance. So that's kind of different methods for that. And then comparing here, you know, what you would get with the three bands and the six bands, you know, and yeah. So, of course, there's much more to it, but it kind of just giving kind of the overview of the experiment. And then we can take it further to, this was a kind of a simulation, and then we can actually make it in practice and then test it again, how it actually works in practice. And of course then comes different things like, well, you actually have two cameras that doesn't see exactly the same. That's the whole idea with stereo, right? They see slightly different images. So what if there is a shadow? What if this camera, you know, doesn't see the same surface element as the other one? Of course there will be problems. There are plenty of things that can, that does happen in that. But the concept is simple and it's actually can be useful. Yeah, there are some papers you can read on that. So that was kind of just a quick glimpse into the stereo approach to multispectral imaging. So another one where we also go very quickly into is using a filter array. So I don't know if you have learned the basics of color imaging, there's always this filter array on the sensor, right? So every pixel can see only a red, green, or blue, you know. Again, very conceptually simple thing. Let's replace that color filter with a spectral filter array. So we have not just three different types of filters, but I don't know how many. So how do we design that? How can that work? So we have done a work on that on kind of different aspects of that. How many channels should we use? What should the spectral sensitivities be? How should they be organized? You know, how should we, you know, make the layout of the filters to get kind of best possible image quality? And also then the demosaicing problem. Once we have a camera like this and we want to recover the full spectrum in every pixel, so we need to do the interpolation just as for color, except that now it's much more difficult. So there's a whole series of research also on the demosaicing and stuff like that. Now you can actually buy cameras that has this spectral filter array. We have one in the lab that we bought from a company. So it's possible to do experiments with it quite easily. We did a lot of our research we did before there was any devices available, so we kind of worked on the more fundamental aspects in simulation of this. So here's some references. I can make a copy of these slides afterwards so that you can have. And then just a little bit about the LED approach. So we have different LEDs with different spectra, illuminated scene with that, and we can create a multispectral image for that. It's not one shot. The two other ones tried to do it in one shot, right? We have two cameras, same time, not click twice. Here you have to take several images after each other. So it doesn't solve all the problems, but it can still be very, very fast, and the switching can be very fast, and it can be a very good approach. So here is one case, one thing we were looking at, an example again of one of the research projects within this area, where we looked at not using a monochrome camera, but using an RGB camera. Because we already have, RGB cameras are very easily available, so can we, with an RGB camera, and then choosing different kind of LEDs, can we make a good spectral, camera with an RGB camera at the basis? It's a very similar question to saying, well, as I said before, we have a monochrome camera. But the problem is that we don't have monochrome cameras so easily. RGB cameras we can easily get to. So then this is a reason for looking at that. So again, you're basing things on same type of linear model. Now, of course, we have to know what are the filters available, or not the filters, what are the LEDs available. So this was one example. They are nicely normalized here so that they look very well spread out. You can see that there are some problems. There are some missing wavelengths here, and some varying widths and stuff like that. So how do we choose the best possible LEDs, and how do we use them together with RGB? Which is not exactly the same as using them if you don't have the RGB sensors, right? So this actually led to a prototype that was made for a specific task. Now, in this case, it was Fujifilm Europe wanted a kind of quality control system to monitor their production of photographic paper. That sounds old now, but photographic paper was. I will not go there. But anyways, this is a kind of good example of a system like that. So with an off-the-shelf single SLR camera and then this specially designed LEDs, you could kind of get a very good result for that application here. And then, these are just some examples of the chosen LEDs, what are the resulting sensitivities, because you have to kind of multiply the LEDs with the RGBs, right? So the RGBs will always be there. You don't not remove them. So then the sensitivities are kind of influenced by that. And then another example of, okay, how do we evaluate a system like this? Whether it's you have made it for real or whether it's simulation. Typically here, some of you might recognize the spectra of the... What is this a spectra of?
What's this?
4x6, layout... Grayscale in the bottom.
That was one more.
Thunder production curve, is it?
Yeah, no.
Well.
So these 24 patches, what is this?
Yes, exactly. So typically now here we use the Macbeth color checker as a test target for this, and then we're comparing the measured or the ground truth spectral reflectances of it and whatever we were able to reconstruct with a certain version of this. And you can see here, well, okay, so we're not able to reconstruct it. No, I'm pointing where you don't see. Here, for instance. So it's not very smooth. Because we have these, we're sampling these kind of very spiky reflectances, so it's not very smooth. But for many purposes, that doesn't matter so much. For other purposes, it might. It depends on what you want to do. Here, there was a clear application where we wanted to kind of control the densities of these films here. So then we also evaluated other, in terms of how well they did measure that for that particular application. So this is also an example where we have the spectral kind of quality, but also the quality of what is it really for? And that could be a diagnosis. How well does it actually predict what you need to do to make a diagnosis of some kind of illness or whatever it is that you really want? It's important to kind of bring that into the quality evaluation. Good. So that was just three concepts quickly with using LED. Using a spectral filter array and using multiple cameras. And then just a little bit about, okay, what happens when we don't know the illumination, right? This is you know, from color imaging, this is a very known scenario, right? You're taking pictures out in wherever, and you want a nicely color balanced image, and the camera or the algorithms behind the camera for a color camera, they will then estimate, okay, what is the light source here? What is the illumination? I need to know that in order to, you know, make the best color calibrated image. So now we're taking this into from color to spectral. And there we have done a few, I'm not going into the details of this, in different ways we have kind of tried to mix the spectral, you know, what has been done on illuminant estimation for color and taking that into the spectral domain. This is one of the first approaches where we have, with some specific filters we had to use in this case. And we also have done, there was a PhD student, Harris, who worked on this for a long time. I'm not going to go into the details here, but just looking at typically again here, how we have some other results to how to select the best possible filter. And then, you know, this was an interesting case of problem with optimization, because we do want the best estimation, the best color, and we also might want the best estimation of the illuminant, because kind of estimating the illuminant is a core part of it. So then we have kind of two things we want to try to optimize at the same time. So, and here, in this case, it was a kind of a brute force optimization. We have a limited set of combinations to compare, so we can kind of compare these and choose. Typically, we ended up choosing this filter here because it kind of minimizes both of them. But if you wanted to do this fully automatically, it's not so obvious to say how, you know, what is the best minimization of these two, because if you have two things you want to optimize, right, you have to weight them together, you have to kind of, so some examples here, just another way to show results really is kind of, okay, here we have some spectral images that are the ground truth. So we have the spectral reflectance in the image. We run them through the system, and we compare what the system would, you know, if we just simulate a perfect capture under a known illuminant, and then we do compare that with what if we don't know the illuminant, and, you know, we use our algorithm to estimate the illuminant, and we're seeing how well it matches. So we, you know, we know that we have the ground truth in our model, but we choose not to use it to validate if our algorithms are working. That's a known kind of experimental setup in simulation. Of course, and then you can kind of quantify that. You can visualize it, you can quantify it, you can measure kind of how well it is. Of course, there's always a challenge when this is still simulation, right? So what happens if you make the system and you go out into the real world and take pictures? Does it still work? There are many reasons why it doesn't always do it.
Columns, let's say the two last columns to the right hand side on the F3. So is the second last one, is that a kind of the reference, and then the very last column is the estimated?
Yes, well, now I see that my illustration is a little, so it could be the other way around, but I think the first one is the reference and this is the one kind of through system. So at least these two should be the same, and here we see it didn't work that well. Here we can see that there were some problems, right? But the other ones kind of compare, you know. But of course, yeah. So that's the idea. Good. I will not go further into this, but we talk about color constancy, right? Now we talk about multispectral constancy. Are we able to generalize the concept of computational color constancy to multispectral images so that when we are taking a picture under unknown, a multispectral image under unknown illumination, are we able to get useful data even if we don't know the illumination? That's kind of the question. And then useful data, of course, that depends on what are you going to use them for, etc. Here we did work on extending these known algorithms from the color domain, the gray world, you know, maybe you have heard about that, you know, we can extend that to spectral and see how things are working. So I will not go more into detail on the results of that, but plenty of papers you can read on that. Good. I want to kind of conclude a little bit on the multispectral here. Gave you kind of introduction, a little bit overview of the state of the art, talking about what are the challenges to you know, going to the lower end of cheap devices, easy to use, you know, can broad range of applicability. What are the things we need to do that? We could have talked, you know, at the other end, or, you know, what do we need to do to make it even more precise and more, you know, higher end, or somewhere in between might be where your needs are. Some four different kind of things I just kind of quickly went into: using multi-camera, filter arrays, LEDs, and then what happens when we don't know the illuminant. What can we do then? Still research to be done. Spectral imaging, spectral image quality. What about the mobile phone? It's not, I'm not kidding when I say mobile phone. I mean, the mobile, you know, the people who make mobile phones, they are interested in spectral imaging. We are talking to them about it. So it's not, you know, yep. That's it for that part. Now I will very quickly kind of just talk about these two projects, because spent a bit more time than I was planning on this. We had some good discussions and everything. So, but any you know, questions or comments on let's say this part before I switch?
So once I have uploaded the slides, please take some time, go through the slides, and then also explore the different. So that gives you a kind of much broader picture of the different topics, and then it's also kind of easier for you to get a kind of a better understanding about the different subjects in that topic, come up with an idea which area you want to explore.
And don't hesitate to email me also. I mean, even if there is a specific topic you're interested in, that there are more literature than what I put out here. I could help you find stuff to read more about and stuff, so that's very possible. So I will now just quickly graze the surface of two huge projects, Change and Appears. And it's relevant for you because, I mean, talking about research, introduction to research in the Color Lab or at Color Vision Computing, a lot of the research we are doing because we have applied for funds, applied for money to pay us to do the research. And we applied to the Research Council of Norway. We can sometimes work with companies, can be a way, or we can apply to the European Union. That's kind of a big source of funding for research. And that, when we get that funding, it allows us to hire, you know, PhD students and postdoc researchers to work together with us who are here as faculty members to do research. And this is really what has been happening throughout the 20 years that we have been working as a lab, that we have done a lot of that. So then when, you know, and then these two projects are special. Well, they're special to me because I'm the coordinator of both of them. But they are quite large. You can see that there are 15 PhD students. Not all of the 15 are here. You know, they're spread around in Europe. In Change, in particular, we have two of them are here, and the rest are one in Trondheim at NTNU, and others are spread around. They are in their very final phase now, and some of the PhD students, you will see, I mean, you will surely get notifications about PhD defenses happening in the next year or so. So I encourage you, if you are around, to take that opportunity to learn more about research by listening to them present what they have been doing for the 3 years. You know, and I think the topic-wise is relevant because, well, still, many of these people are these PhD students. They are working on these topics, and they could be interested in collaborating with you for your, you know, projects now and next semester, etc. And also, these are, you know, ongoing research topics that will continue also after these PhD students are finished. So I mean, there's plenty of research to do in these areas. So with change project, it stands for, you know, cultural heritage analysis for new generations. It's really about using imaging technology for the cultural heritage field. And it's spectral imaging, it's 3D imaging, and also other modalities. And it's to be able to measure objects of cultural heritage, you know, tangible cultural heritage that actually change over time, and they all do, you know, because there are plenty of reasons why things change, and we want to kind of control that, measure that, some maybe stop the change, or you know, help the conservators do their job to preserve them, etc. And as I mentioned, many different imaging modalities. There's a lot of hyperspectral, a lot of 3D in the project. And I will kind of just, well, these are kind of just examples of changes. It could be before and after cleaning, for instance. How to document this change. And this is complicated because sometimes, you know, a lot of things can happen when you start, you know, cleaning and taking away layers of a surface like this. So here's from the University of Oslo, more close-up of kind of cleaning tests. So I will, you know, we'll not go into it more, just kind of give you a glimpse. I think, you know, I will share the slides afterwards. To say that, I mean, one very important part of a project like this is not just the research we're doing, but it's also the training. So when you're in a master program, this is a, you know, a PhD program, and the learning and training continues. There's a lot of focus on the research they're doing, but still, you know, there's also the aspect of kind of training to become an experienced researcher, an independent researcher. This is just a nice group picture to kind of show the team. Let's see. I'm going to skip these kind of things just to say... I think Sony talked about the other things we're doing. I mean, we have worked quite a lot at the Color Lab on cultural heritage related research. A lot of spectral imaging of the scream. I'm sure he showed you some this ugly face here before. And I'll just go quickly through the. You know, the ESR, just to show you the faces. These are ESRs, early stage researchers, PhD students. And yes, they're here working on stained glass windows, hyperspectral imaging of stained glass windows. He's here in the lab. Dipendo working on quality in spectral imaging of cultural heritage. Evdokia in Trondheim. You know, you can look back into this, look at their topics. I also invite you to check the website, the changeitn.eu. And if you see something you would like to, you know, follow up, or something you would like to do some research, you know, some literature study on, you know, something like this, I mean, there's plenty of good topics here. So that was... very quick glimpse into the change project, and I will and then also do a similarly very short and not so nice introduction to the APEARS project. And that links with, you said that some will start to talk about appearance and multi-angle measurements and stuff from color to appearance. Now here, this project is the same type of project, 15 PhD students, kind of same size European project, but now the topic is how can we measure appearance and how can we control the appearance in reproducing, you know, in printing-based reproduction, and particularly 3D printing, but also 2.5D printing and 3D printing. 2.5D printing, does that make sense to you? Do you understand what, have you heard about it? Okay. So does it just natively make sense, or have you somebody told you about it before? Yes, exactly. Yes, of course. Yes, because I'm thinking that 2.5D is kind of hard to imagine, but you have learned it. Okay. So yes, so I mean, in the Appears Expo, you got a good glimpse into what this project is all about. So and then I really don't have to say much more about that. And also, I think this kind of motivation for it, maybe, well, you know, 3D printing is really, 2.5D maybe it's not so well known, but 3D printing, you know, everyone talks about it, it's kind of happening a lot in the world, you know, a lot of development there. But most, until recently, mostly the challenge has been to get the right shape, right? You know, and then the next question is maybe the right mechanical properties, because if you're going to use it for something, you know, if it breaks right away, it's not really useful to kind of make it something that has the right physical properties. And what we are kind of advocating is that, well, you have to care about how it looks also. And for many applications, that will actually make a difference. So how can we make it look the way we want? Appearance, color, sure, but it's not just color, you know, it's appearance. And so much things have happened the last, you know, 5 years in this. You can print things that look amazingly good, and has very, you know, you can more and more kind of control the appearance properties. But very often still there is kind of trial and error kind of thing. It's hard to say, well, I want it to look this way. I want to make an exact copy of an original, or I want to design an object with a certain appearance, and getting that is hard because they're, you know. Because it's so complex, and that's why, you know, there's a lot of research we have done on this, and you know, some of it is more basic, and how do we measure appearance? What is really appearance? You know, this is the, you know, computer graphics spheres. You know, do they have the same color? Well, yeah, well, you know, maybe that depends. You know, they certainly don't look the same, right? Clearly, but you know, maybe they have the same color but different, you know, glossiness. Is it even meaningful to say that they have the same color? You know, because then we tend to think that they are the same, right? They look the same, and they don't. So yes, it's quite. I find it, you know, they appear. You know, others will talk more about appearance, but kind of color is so fascinating, right? You know, and because we try to measure it, and it looks, you know, differently, and you know, appearance is just as color, just, you know, even more complex and interesting. So well, if you measure it well, that depends then on the geometry of the measurement instrument. I think if the you know, I don't know, your spectrophotometer, what it would do with this, we don't really know, because they're not, it's not designed to measure this. Anyway, so I will not go more into appearance, but this, you know, how to model it, how to understand it, how to measure it, and how to control your printer to reproduce it is kind of what it's all about. And there are many application areas where actually, you know, 3D printing and appearance, you know, prosthesis, kind of making them look right, teeth, they're very also, you know, can 3D print a tooth. It's, you know, it's not easy to get it to look right. You know, you really want your nice pearly white smile to look perfect, even if you have a fake tooth, right? Like artistic applications, you know, can you design objects that are supposed to look nice, or look the way you want them to look, and kind of play with their appearance in the creative process? Automotive, other kind of luxury materials, or different products, actually, where you can 3D print parts. This is actually a 3D printed eye prosthesis. It doesn't work. you don't see with it, but actually you can. It's a big market, and actually kind of very useful to do that. Cultural heritage, other application area where there's a lot of things, and I think that's what I will say about that. Big network again, the very important thing with building projects like this, but, and research in general. You know, if I'm going to say to you, you know, build your networks. You know, talk to people. You know, both here and in all of your institutions. UCOSI, you are so lucky because you will go out of the program really, you know, having contacts in many parts in the world, and that is a key to further career. And particularly in research, but also in industrial careers. So work on your networks. Here are the LPC students, just ones you can meet here. You know, Majid, he's in the Color Lab working on a measurement system downstairs. I'm sure you have a chance to look at that. So multi-angle, you know, so you can, you have the sample here, you have a camera up here, you have the light source, you can move the sample, you can move the camera in different kind of, you can rotate it. Tom, he's also here, but he's physically not here now this semester. Maybe you saw him at the expo, he's in New Zealand now. Ali is here, yeah. 15 PhD students, or 16 actually now. Yes, that nicely signals the end of this. yeah, I mean,
yes.
Any comments about these projects or about appearance and culture heritage or?
Okay.
It's a bit faster. Yeah.
Yes, thanks, John. As soon as I get the slides,
yep.
I will upload them. And then we continue tomorrow for the past 10 in here with translucency. Okay.
There are many possible relations between multispectral and ICC profiling, but what are you thinking about, or what? How do you think? So, if I were to talk about similarities, if you talk about the camera, what you want to do with a profile is to be able to make the camera give you a consistent, you know, measurements related to a standard. So, in typical color management, that would be a standard color space, standard RGB or LAB or something like that. That when we say spectral, we go away from the three-dimensional kind of color reference, but it's the same thing. You need to kind of calibrate your system. You want to use it to measure something, repeatability, you know, and those kind of things. But now maybe you focus on more spectral data, more color data. And there's also actually, in the extension of today's color management system, ICC, the ICC Max is kind of the framework for that can do spectral data. So it's possible to kind of do this kind of calibration, and the workflow for spectral imaging you can do within an ICC workflow, and some of our PhD students are doing that actually. That you could talk to Thomas and say, well, you know, there are many so there are many possible links between the two.
Two of them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm interested in cultural heritage.
Yes.
I just wanted to explore that. Which kind of like. What can I research on it, or can I learn? There's many, lots
yes.
of them, but I wanted to have a literature review on that
yes.
part.
I think it's necessary to focus, to kind of choose something within
yes.
within that field.
I just got the slide, so I have to go through like which.
Yes.
And I can, but actually.
But then we could talk more about, okay, what do you want, or you know, do you have you know, is there a reason why you're interested in, you know, we could try to find the right subset within this field that would match kind of what you want to do.
I am kind of understanding these things like after Sonny Giorgio's lecture.
Yes.
Here, I kind of understanding this getting into my head.
Yeah.
So upbeat colors and other things are not just getting that much into me, but spectral imaging is getting into my head.
Right.
And
okay.
The hair cultural things,
mm-hmm.
is really making me interested. Like the pictures and the research about it, it's making me interested.
Yeah. So what I would suggest to start with, I don't know what the slides he Sony showed, because we I have also a slide set where I'm talking
it's
about
kind of similar.
Yeah,
but he talked about more widely.
Yes.
The multispectral.
And hyperspectral.
Yes.
Because it could be a subset of those.
Yeah.
You know, from
yeah,
from
there
a specific.
There is lots of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a large wide
area.
Yes. But I had to pick one.
When do you have to pick that one? You know, because I would say yes, you should be doing
I
a bit more digging.
Yeah, digging. But I saw the subsets. Yeah, like there is a forensic thing and others for food.
Yes.
Medicals, but yeah, I like all of them. But cultural just
mm-hmm.
is more interesting for me.
Because I mean, you could say. Because there are many reasons to do spectral imaging of cultural heritage, but one typical thing that we try to do is to try to estimate, okay, which are the pigments that have been used, what are the colors that have been used. And typically, let's say, take a painting and take a spectral image of that, and then we would like to know, is this
which
cobalt blue, is it kind of, what, you know, is it viridian
green?
You
guys are saying that it's fake or not.
That could be, but even before that, you know, you try to kind of
recognize,
Of course, what could happen is that if you do this and you say, well, here they use this pigment, and that was not invented at the time, you know, that would be a proof that this is a fake. But that's a specific case of that.
Yes.
But that is a topic that is kind of is relatively well defined somehow, to also for literature review, because it's not like I want to do multispectral imaging for whatever. I want to do multispectral imaging, and I would like to be able to kind of estimate the pigments.
Yeah.
So then that would kind of limit a little bit the scope of what you would be doing. And it's relevant for, I mean, we have some recent research in the lab, like Federico, for instance, a PhD student, he's been working on that now. Hilda, who's a researcher here, has also kind of worked on that. So it has a good relationship to things we have been doing. And it's not a fully solved problem. So off my top of my head, that could be one, but there are also other more challenging tasks. You could say, what about combining 3D and multispectral, for instance? You know, that is challenging. That's an interesting topic also. But maybe this. Well, I don't know. Why don't you? Why don't you, if you want to kind of know more, I want to pursue it, why don't you email me also?
Yes.
And I can, we can have
some papers and we can have a meeting.
Yeah, yes. Definitely. So I'm happy to.
So in the slide, your mail will be there, right?
Yes, it will be there. You can also write it down now if you like.
Yeah.
Sure. Just in case it takes some time. And if I don't answer, then email me again, because just sometimes I get so many emails that I don't, you know. But I really want to follow up this. But don't be afraid to ask again, to kind of